The following recording is offered by the Village Zendo. For more information, please visit villagezendo.org.
Good evening, everyone. I should say evening, everyone. There is one person here I don't know. My name is Miyoko. And nice to have you here. You'd think this would get easier, but it's amazing. It's funny, somehow this week I had been just sort of thinking about what to talk about, and I had been thinking somehow about forgiveness and perseverance, and in all honesty, I was really thought I was going to be having to give some talk that was going to deal with how to keep persevering in duty getting a denial of parole. I just was, bracing myself. There was hope upon hope and this kind of ongoing optimism, but there's just always been doubt. There was just no knowing. But either way, the activity of engaging in that effort, regardless of the outcome, made a big difference in her life, and I think in all the lives in life. And then a miracle occurred. After 37 years, the state of New York showed mercy and decided to actually give her such a well-earned parole. But like most miracles, on one hand, it was a miracle. It easily could have gone the other way, but God, it was the result of the efforts of so many different people from so many different places and walks of life over extended periods of time. It didn't just happen. And I was just a small part of that, and I would never have been able to be such a part of that if it hadn't been for the tremendous effort of the Village Zendo as a whole, for which, I am eternally grateful, and I'm sure Judy is eternally grateful. And, I reached out to many different communities, and most of the time I felt like a nag or, just throwing a nickel into like a pond of, oh, that's too bad. Okay, well, but not the Village Zendo. So I really just, there aren't words for what this community has done. But I just do have to say, in particular, of course, Roshi was tremendous in what she continued to do. And Rinsho was a lion on Judy's behalf. actually was able to do way more probably than I ever could have dreamed of. And Miyagetsu was always just right there. And there are many others, but, you know, they deserved mentioning. You know, but, and the whole movement, really, that's going on now for criminal justice and parole reform, which is huge and finally really starting to gain some traction, because without that, I don't think this ever would have happened now. You know, there was political cover for them to make this decision. So it's so important that this effort continue, because she is just one among countless numbers who are just lost in this system that is, you know, the closer you get to it, you realize just how barbaric and torture. It's just torture for everyone involved. Everyone who spends any time in any prison on either side of those bars. Obviously, it's worse if you're on the side where you can't ever leave, but it's truly a hell realm that continues that way because it's just out of sight, out of mind, and there's so much money to be made. But anyway, it's really uplifting when something really wonderful actually happens in the midst of so much darkness that we seem to be living in at this moment. You know, there's always light, but, but so this quality of forgiveness was very much present for this to happen. And in my own experience, it's actually about one of the most difficult things that we can have or that we can do. Practice. It's equal parts one of the most liberating things we can do, as much for ourselves in the act of forgiveness as it is for whomever or whatever it is that we're forgiving. And in that way, I think it's really kind of like the true or ultimate expression. And recognition, really, of emptiness, of the relationality of all beings. It's not there or here. In forgiveness, there's no difference. But it's always one of those things that seems much simpler and easier when it's somebody else. You just think, why can't they just get over it? It's not such a big deal, really. And I've taken it to be kind of an exercise whenever I catch myself thinking that, to think, you know, to kind of come back, pause a minute and think about, well, maybe who is it that I haven't quite completely forgiven yet? Or what is it, or whom am I still carrying around? And oftentimes I'll find that many times people that I think I have forgiven, and in many ways have forgiven, it will still pop up, you know, a rage or a hurt or disappointment or whatever. You know, it's not, forgiveness is not really a one-time act, has been my experience. We tend to need to forgive again and again and again. You know, but I will say that I find that each time it can get easier. You know, every time we do it, it allows us to change, if even a little bit. And it makes space and allows for the other person to change as well. So as we are not the same, if we really look and stay here and now, neither are they. But if we stay stuck, which is God knows so easy to do, it's hard to believe and to see that the world is not just as stuck. You know, because perspective is key. And if our perspective can't shift, not much else can actually shift either. And it just continues to become clearer and clearer to me how time, as time goes on, really how it's just all those old wounds and hurts that shape us. And until we really address and meet them, they continue to freeze us and hold us in these closed shapes that we don't see because they actually form the way we see. It's because they're so deeply familiar and internalized, we really can't possibly see them on our own. And it's interesting. I thought about, and I was thinking how, for whatever reasons, I've always been actually very drawn to the familiar, and revisiting the familiar. I mean, I actually love the familiar, you know, like a lot of people always want to go someplace new if they're going to go traveling or go out to a restaurant. Like I could just go to like the same place again and again and again and again. I don't know. I like to be comfortable, I think. I don't think it's just comfort, but there is something, there's just, So, you know, it's interesting because you can see that I'm quite happy with what a lot of people I know find quite boring. It's like, it's just to me, there's something to be doing the same thing again and again and again and again. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so suited to making pots, because that's really, for much of the time, how potters work. Which is in series, you know, but even going to the same restaurant again, never feels like the same restaurant. It's just always different. It's like coming to the Zendo. You know, I don't think in 25 years I've ever come to the Zendo two times and it's been exactly the same. There has never been the same exact configuration of people, of weather, of sound, you know, of really everything. It is never the same. And we do the same thing again and again and again and again and again. And it just doesn't get old. It bizarrely gets more different. It's just very mysterious. But so, you know, it's interesting with pots, you know, because many potters, it's just natural to work in series for particular kinds of work, particularly work that's made on the wheel, which is not the only way that I work, but it is one way that I really enjoy working, partly, I think, for this reason. And there's other people who this drives crazy. So it's like, at first glance, you see this row of pots, and this is even before they're glazed and everything, they look the same. But then you really look at them, holding them side by side, and it actually becomes really clear they're not. They're not actually the same at all. But we most often don't look that way, you know. More often than not, when we look at something, we see the idea of the thing rather than actually see the thing or see the object or see the person. It's often our image or our impression of the thing, rather than spending the time or giving it the attention to let that particular thing or person in that moment reveal itself. And, you know, I think I've spoken of this before, but this very subtle quality of difference becomes really most apparent to me when I'm asked to replicate something. You know, something comes out really nice and well, can you make another one? And I used to say, oh, sure, I'll make another one. And then I'd really be sweating it because, of course, I can't actually really ever make another one. It's just not going to happen. It could be similar, but it's never, ever going to be the same. You know, all the externals remain identical, but the proportion of the relationships in time are always different. So, you know, you could say for better or worse, this is really the beauty of the handmade. It's never just the execution of an idea, but it is always really the expression of a particular moment or series of moments. And sometimes it's a good one, and sometimes it's maybe not such a good one. But whatever it is, interestingly, it always ultimately remains outside, like sort of just outside our control. Which, you know, I think is much like reality, which I think the older we get, the more we realize it always lies, no matter what we do, just somewhere outside our control. And again, sometimes it works out really well, and we call that good, and sometimes not. And, you know, we call that bad, and when it's bad, we more often than not call it a mistake. And so, God knows we all make mistakes and are part of mistakes. But often, like with most things, when we really start to go into it and ponder it, this nature of mistake can sort of dissolve. So, you know, I was thinking that like one way of looking at mistakes could be that which ends up not being what was intended. In other words, our intention is one thing, but then what happens during the execution is actually something quite different. And so in its simplest form, we could say, well, that's a mistake. So say with a pot, because that's how I say things. It doesn't make this pot, and it just doesn't look or feel right for whatever reason. And in the beginning, and when I started, I would want to immediately get rid of those things. I wouldn't want them around. I wouldn't want to have to look at them. They seemed ugly to me. They seemed disturbing to me. They made me feel inadequate. They just did not want to. I just wanted to clear them out and move on to make what I thought was good and right, and where everything worked. The longer I work, the more I find it the most valuable to keep those pieces around, actually. And, you know, oftentimes when a pot feels really wrong, I don't know right away why, you know. And as I said, no matter what, when you're making, even if you can make the same damn thing that just seems so simple again, and it will never come out the same. Like, it's just... and it's very mysterious. And when something is just really off, it's really can be not clear what's going on here. Like, why is that? And it isn't really until, and it can sometimes be over a year of just having it around, looking at it and studying it and just sort of letting it, absorbing it, that it might let me know what the issue was. And then I'll throw it out, because then it's not interesting anymore. It's sort of like, once you know, then, you know, I don't need to have it around anymore. It's the same thing when things work. Sometimes something really works. Once I kind of know why and it's done, it's not really that interesting to me anymore. It's when, wow, how did that happen? Did I do that? Like, what? Anyway. But something else that's interesting is that what's going on may never be something that I can actually see, but somebody can come over to the studio and look at something and immediately see, oh, this is what's happening. And they are coming from a completely different perspective and can see it in a way that on my own, I was not capable of seeing. I mean, just the other day, I did this piece and I was just doing it as kind of like a glaze test or whatever. And then I had it and it was like, the results were, you know, and then I was gonna, I had it in my throwout pile and my studio mate, Paul, came over and looked at me. He was like, oh my God, you know, this is such a good piece. And I was like, you know, it wasn't even a piece at that time, but it was this completely different way of seeing something that consequently shifted how I could see it. It could be the reverse, could be like, this really sucks. You know, I mean, it's not always a good thing. And that can be really helpful too, as to why, what's not working here. So, you know, I found that as we see what is problematic, what is not working, what's disturbing, you know, that's insight. That's where the insights are. And it's these insights that I think that lead to something often that's way richer and more complex than what our original intention or idea was or is. And a transformation occurs in that perception. And when that transformation occurs, is this mistake still a mistake? So on one hand, we could say yes. But then perhaps the whole meaning of mistake changes through this process, and the nature of mistake is now not the same thing. It's no longer a purely negative or destructive thing, because it's our mistakes that really hold the potential to take us beyond what we already know and beyond who we already believe ourselves to be. But this doesn't happen without a lot of careful and deep reflection and acknowledgement that something is not working as it is. It's not just, oh, whatever, whatever. You know, and regretfully, we also make mistakes in our relations with other people, and needless to say, the consequences of these mistakes are of a very different order than a bad pot. You know, so more often than not, without meaning to, we make mistakes all the time in which people get hurt. And sometimes it's just a little, and sometimes It can be a lot, and sometimes it can be catastrophically. And often it's in that mid-range. And you could say from one perspective, part of what it is to just be alive, to be a sentient being, means to be hurt and also to hurt others. And again, more often than not, unintentionally. But this unintentionality doesn't really necessarily make the pain suffered any less on its own, which is why really every spiritual tradition has some kind of process for atonement, for reparations, for making amends inside ourselves and with others. And hopefully this will help us to create less harm inside ourselves and so to others. And in our tradition, the way we do this really is through the precepts. Because these just provide us these guidelines, in a sense, for our behavior that also serve as mirrors and doorways into the self. They provide a language and a means for looking at the dynamics that may be at play in any given relationship or situation, and particularly those that are hurtful, uncomfortable, and just seem incomprehensibly off. You know, and by definition, there is never just one side, but by ourselves, at first glance, that's always what we see is one side. And so these precepts really can help us see the many sides and dimensions comprising our own views and our own feelings. The views and emotions that come into play through relationship. And otherwise, we don't often see them. I'm never happier than when I'm alone in my studio and I don't have to deal with anyone. You know, life is very good there. But often to my dismay, I can't just stay there. So what comes into play? It could be our fear, could be our anger, it could be our anxiety, could be our attractions, it could be our aversions. A lot of things going on. And if we pay attention, you know, we may find ourselves lying, not telling the truth much of the time, because maybe we're afraid people will run away from us if they knew who we really were. What's that fear really about? Or be angry, you know? What is that? Perhaps we're blaming others in the world constantly for something that feels wrong? Could it be that we're actually avoiding reflecting on our own mistakes or taking responsibility for what is our own peace in any given very difficult situation? You know, what is it that we're afraid to see? Perhaps we find that we're constantly talking about others' errors and faults, pointing them out with the good intentions of illumination for others, you know, but maybe that's really just to bolster ourselves up or a means to create bonds with others or something else. Maybe it's avoiding the difficult conversation that needs to be had with that person that we're speaking of. And that's, boy, is that an easy one to fall into. Or resorting to anger before, without first really looking within, not acknowledging our own peace for what is happening right now, not taking responsibility. Anyway, there are just infinite ways, and the precepts really help us to see, because it's often in the moment, it can be very hard to even begin to discern what's happening, particularly because when we're uncomfortable, we batten down the hatches instinctually. And usually, I've found, it's because we think we're protecting ourselves. But often it's not even conscious enough that we even think that. For my own self, I'm just beginning to say, get a glimpse at how much I keep people at a distance, because I'm certain on some level that they're just waiting to hurt me. This isn't conscious. It's becoming conscious. But, and these things, subtle how they can play out. I project it, and I project that onto others. It's them being aloof. So as we reflect on ourselves, essentially, you know, it really becomes more or less inevitable, I think, that we find more compassion for others, you know, and the deeper we go in, those lines between others and ourselves really become a lot less clear. And, you know, we can't always do it every second of every day, you know, but a crucial aspect of our practice is really to reflect on this dukkha, on this suffering, that we have a piece in creating, and that's not just thrust upon us. And our practice, which makes it possible, I think, for us to really look, is to bring our mind of Zazen into this reflection. And so even if it's for just a few seconds, the dropping of the judging and the capacity to just see or just listen openly, curiously, and very importantly, humbly. And with this mind, I have found It was pretty much the only time that voice of judgment will begin to actually reveal herself on a subtler level. When the judgment is too strong, the demons just go deeper in and remain hidden. You know, it's really just our turning our own inner light of compassion and forgiveness that will allow our true selves to reveal themselves to ourselves. And it's a very humbling process when we really see what's there. And the more we see it in ourselves, we just naturally and instinctually can begin to see it in others. It's not foreign. You know, there are just wells of sorrow, of anger, of disappointment, of envy. All around us. But I see how it's when it's unrecognized that is when it becomes really hurtful to others and to myself. So it's through our recognition and awareness, I believe, that forgiveness also becomes possible for what we've done and for what others have done. But there is a lightness, a freedom, a porosity, and a possibility for more and future opening and softening. And there is a peace with that, even in the midst of that. Sometimes shame, sometimes discomfort, whatever form it may take. So I'm almost done. I think I ran over time, but just wanted to say that really, among many other things, you know, this is really one of the biggest treasures of Sangha, and it's the Village Zendo has such an extraordinary Sangha. And this treasure, as I said, it's not always comfortable. It can often be the thing we wish would make us leave, you know. Would just be the Village Zendo would be so great if it just weren't for all those people I have to deal with. But this is actually where the deepest power and the deepest beauty is. And I would say that dialogue, and particularly the dialogue we most dread, is the means of seeing what we can't see on our own. It's only through these relations that we see what's going on, and it's going on anyway, but we can't see it by ourselves. And hopefully in Sangha, we can have these difficult conversations that can open something in us beyond what we already know and beyond what we already think of ourselves. And about the other person. You know, over time, We see ourselves and we see others change. But, you know, it's often also so gradual that we don't. Sometimes we can think we've just changed and we don't take into account that the other person is not the same person that we were relating to 5 years ago. They've changed also. So it's so important to recognize, you know, that as we change, so can and do others change. And our practice is to continually come back to where we are right now and allow for that to be different. To allow for it to not be the same and to assume that it's the same. And this sounds like it should be so easy, but you know, these habits run deep and they take a lot of time and attention to shift. And it's very messy. And so we call it practice because we have to do it again and again and again. And we will probably hurt each other in the midst of trying to do this because it's practice and it's messy and we're all hurt and we're all vulnerable and we're all trying to do the best we can in this world. But so we have to just keep trying to see with fresh eyes and to be open to the fact that they may be clouded in ways that we don't know. And it takes others to help us discover this. So, you know, I think we all know this, that there's really, I don't think, any more difficult or important practice than trying to get along with those we disagree with in particular, those we feel we dislike or feel uncomfortable with. It's hard enough doing that with the people we think we agree with and feel good about. At the end of the day, it really makes no difference how we should treat anybody, if we love them or we hate them, you know. That's our practice. Doesn't really matter. So I just encourage us all to look deeply into ourselves with the eyes of compassion and forgiveness. And as we may do that, we just may find the whole world right there.